Okay, welcome back everyone to For the Property Investor podcast. And we have another expert series interview today with Joe Vadillo. Thank you, Joe, for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure, Owen.
And now we've known each other for quite a while now. And I know what you do as a buyer's agent, and the good work that you do working with investors specifically, and that's what we want to talk about here is working with investors, and how you help them. So yeah, give me the story of how you started off as a buyer's agent.
Is it the elevator pitch or the more lingering at the catering table? A party.
Give us the real meat and potatoes, dirty stuff. Yeah.
Look, the truth of the matter is I was already an obsessive when it came to property. So I was a property investor myself. I was working full-time in a corporate job, and I was almost a buyer's agent by pro bono. The language or even the terminology of being a buyer's agent really didn't exist in Australia at that point. But I was already doing the work. I was helping friends negotiate, telling them how they can buy property, what they need to look out for. And it was actually just an evolution it was very popular in America or North America, the buyer's agent's philosophy. And I retrained at 2011, 2012, and got my real estate agent's license. And literally just traded as a buyer's agent. And without word of a lie, I think I spent the first 3 years of that business people going, well, why would I use an expert? Why would I pay someone to help me buy a property? And also, what the hell is a buyer's agent anyway? Yeah. And the popularity has just snowballed. And now, you know, it's very, very common language that someone will say, I've used a buyer's agent. I personally used a buyer's agent back in that era because I had young kids and I was buying interstate and I wasn't in the position to travel easily. And I guess the answer to, you know, working with a buyer's agent is you use an expert when you sell a property, but investors make mistakes buying into a property. And that's sometimes when the best uplift is there. When you buy a fantastic property, when you negotiate the best price, you might be naive. Well, I should say the word naive, but there's just like, you know, lack of experience where you buy a property and unbeknownst to you, there's a DA approval for a boarding house that's going to be built next door, that's going to have windows shining into your back, into your backyard. So
well, let's go back a step there where you first started. You spent the first 3 years explaining what it is you actually were. What's the difference? How did you go with dealing with sales agents at that time? And what's the difference now?
Look, at the time, you know, it was very green. Like some people were thinking I'm after a slice of their commission. So I did come up against a few of the older agents sort of going, well, I'm not sharing my commission. It's like, no, I work for the buyer. I don't work for you or your seller. I'm here to get the best price for them and I'm representing them. So I did actually have to navigate that a little bit. Now, I never have those conversations anymore. And in actual fact, selling agents say we love working with buyer's agents. Cool. Because selling agents, especially when they're buying on behalf, they've got a first-time buyer potentially as looking at the property they're listed. They also have to help nurture that, explain how to put an offer in. Make sure, you know, this is how you put a deposit down. You know, if you're trying to make an offer before auction, trying to explain to someone, you kind of need to come in with a really strong auction-stopping, you know, price. And working with a buyer's agent means that they can just focus on the sale. They know that I will help navigate all of that. And between the two of us, it's kind of a bit of a weird dance because it's my job to look after the buyer. It's their job to look after the seller. And we're trying to come to a win-win, heads of agreement, everyone's happy and secure a property. And everyone wants the same outcome, Owen. Like, we want to buy the property. They want to sell the property. Everyone wants good terms and everyone wants to walk away with a really good feel about the circumstance around the sale. No one wants to have it that they feel like they wound up paying way more than they should have or that they let the property go too cheap or that the terms weren't, you know, agreeable or something like that. So my job, it's tenfold. Like, I'm navigating solicitors, brokers, my client, the agent, sometimes a tricky vendor. It could be that I'm also doing marriage counselling with my clients who can't agree with themselves on the property. And I'm also along the way explaining why is this a good investment? you know, the reason I've sent this to you is because it's got this potential, or the location is flourishing and it's already had an approval for IKEA 10 minutes up the road. And so it's very educational, a lot of what I do as well.
Cool. And have you over the years changed between working with owner occupiers and investors from time to time, or have you always had an even split?
It does fluctuate. My passion is working with investors because that's what I do, and I'm still a very active property investor myself. So I really, I've done it all, you know, in terms of so I really have put my money where my mouth is. So I understand the journey of an investor. Buying into strata, buying with the self-managed super fund, buying interstate rather. So I understand that journey, but in some markets, the economy isn't favourable to investing. So for various reasons, I have wound up having a larger slice of my business leaning towards owner-occupiers. You know, and that could be just, I'm Sydney-based, but I also help investors in Queensland, New South Wales, and I have done a little bit of stuff in WA and also Victoria, and I do a lot of stuff in collaboration with other buyers agents as well. But for whatever reason, the Sydney market's going gangbusters, and people are, you know, owner occupiers are, you know, selling their apartment and they're about to have their first baby, and they turn around and they go to buy a house, and lo and behold, Sydney market's gone crazy and they no longer can buy what they could have 6 weeks earlier. That's when my phone rings hot. Like, we're desperate. A baby's due in 4 months. You know, we need help. So for various reasons, different markets, dictate a little bit of what percentage we're working with predominantly, whether that's investors as well or owner-occupiers.
Okay. So when it comes to investors and you're buying across multiple states, what is it you look for? Is there a particular strategy that you specialize in for your clients, or that you look for clients who are interested in that strategy, does it come down to the client?
I guess the answer is it is a bespoke service. So I will speak to a client that goes, I'm pre-approved for this, you know, $700,000. I know I want to invest. I have no idea where to invest. I don't know what to look out for. Others will come to me and go, we really want a renovator, or I'm looking for something that's got really high yield, or I want to eventually. And so it depends a little bit. When I first meet a client, I want to get a sense of their risk aversion, their experience. I've actually talked people back from buying crazy high-end renovations, only because, especially when the block comes on and the auctions are on and everyone makes $700,000 and they're like, yes, I want a renovator. And I have to say, look, you know, you live in Sydney, you're buying in Brisbane. It's not as easy. It's not a rinse and repeat formula. There's a lot of factors that, you know, aren't disclosed on the TV.
If they can quit their job and they got $500,000 in the bank, you know, for just in case, it's sure, go for it. But not many people are in that position.
And unfortunately, it's my job sometimes to rain on their parade a little bit as well, because I love the concept of flipping, but the market's not favourable. And don't forget, you've got to pay tax in and tax out and holding costs. And by the end of all of this, and then you've had, 20% contingency on your budget, you're really going to have to have a massive uplift if you're going to make some money at the other end of the pot if you want to sell it, you know, within 12 months. So sometimes it's for me to sort of say, have a think about this strategy. How about we look at it from a long-term perspective? Or we're looking at a cosmetic renovation, not a big structural renovation, so you can modernise the blinds and the light switches and, you know, things like that. So it's very cosmetic. It's just carpet and paint. And then other times that people really need a high-yielding property, what we love is the dual-key properties or duplexes, because, you know, you've got two incomes under one roof line. If one of your tenants moves out, you've still got income coming from the other side. And a lot of people get very nervous about vacancy periods, but I've been an investor for a long time. I'm talking, you know, like, I've been anchored badly with an empty property, never, ever. And my advice to people, when they are nervous about doing that, it's just, I don't know, if you're after $400 a week, make it $390, make it $380. Don't leave it on the market for 3 weeks to chase $10.
That's music to my ears, Joe. As property managers, it's like, it's your biggest cost as an investor, once you've bought the property, is vacancy. and you'd rather get $10 or even $20 a week less to get at least straight away rather than waiting around 4 weeks to get that magic number that you had in your head. Yes, and we work with a lot of Duolox and Duplexes, and buyer's agents, they love them. Because investors love them for the reasons that you just talked about with the high rental yield and the two incomes to make sure you've always got one for just in case.
I'm a massive convert and they sell like hotcakes. They absolutely sell like hotcakes. So people are like, but if I buy one of these, who's going to buy it on the other end? It could be another investor, likelihood that there is. It could be a young family that want to have, an income from the two-bedroom side where it's just leased as a granny flat. It could genuinely be a generational, everyone living, multi-generational situation where grandma and grandpa lives on one side. So, and I've actually, like I said, put my money where my mouth is. I built a dual key and it finished up. Oh, it was like the cusp of Christmas. I think it was like the last business day before Christmas. So not ideal. Rented out immediately. One side was rented out immediately. The other one was as soon as the agency came back, 2 days after the agency returned from Christmas break, it was rented out. So my uplift and the return on investment is like astonishing. Like it is brilliant. So this is the things I just share with clients because I live it. I breathe it. I know what you need to look out for. I know the... Sometimes you might be chasing yield, but you're buying in an area with really poor capital growth and it needs to be a little bit of both that works in your favor. And as a buyer's agent and an active investor, this is the information I share with people. They'll show me something that's super remote and, you know, way west of the coastline. And you're like, yeah, look, great rental yield. But, you know, you've got no long-term, you know, growth is pretty much, you know, a bit sketchy.
Yeah. And in my past life, I was a mortgage broker. And there used to be restrictions on lending for duplexes and Duolox and those types of properties. But nowadays, because there's a lot more of them and the turnover of them are a lot more, there aren't those restrictions anymore. So, the concerns for some people that, it used to be valid. But if banks are okay with it, then, there shouldn't be any issue.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the councils, especially around Brisbane, are easing up a lot of the restrictions, even around having a granny flat at the back of your property. Mm. Because once upon a time, it had to be leased, but as you know, the house and the granny flat were under one lease, or they were known to each other. But because we've got this absolute surplus of immigration coming in, housing is not in any way going to be meeting what's happening. So they're easing up a lot of those rules where. And again, with investors, I'm looking at a property where could you fit a granny flat in the back? Maybe you don't want to do it now. Maybe it's a 5-year plan, or perhaps you sell it with the dream for another investor to come in and put the granny flat out the back. But again, granny flats return really strong yields. You know, it's definitely something to explore.
And it's an easy and effective way of trying to help this rental crisis. And that's why governments from federal all the way down to local are pushing for these dual occupancies and the granny flats and so on, because it's a way of not having to increase infrastructure costs hugely by being able to put that second dwelling on an existing property and fairly quickly and easily. And it's having a major positive impact. Unfortunately, these things don't make it out into the media. It's not something that gets a lot of positive feedback. What type of feedback when you talk about Duolox? I know you said some people ask about are they going to be able to resell easily? Mm-hmm. Is there any other feedback about Duolox and granny flats?
It's mostly received really well from investors. Like most of the feedback. And when I speak to agents, because I'm always trying to find off-market properties also. After being a buyer's agent for so many years now, I've got these great networks where I've got those go-to agents, you know, they've always got a little sneaky something up their sleeve. And I also get off-markets coming to me organically via email and text. Like Friday is my day when I get slammed with all these Yep, don't have a buyer for that, but it sounds great, you know, kind of day. But agents are saying they literally can't find them, like they can't list them fast enough. So the feedback from the agents is positive. The fact that, you know, the finance world and you know, it, you know, they're all sort of coming to, you know, an agreement here that this dual income duplexes, it's here to stay. You know, the granny flats, it's here to stay. Like, you know, right. We're running out of land. There's a land scarcity and everyone wants to be as close as they can to infrastructure and the city. And it's an inevitable formula. And when I work with clients, I do look for properties that perhaps have untapped value add opportunities. So, okay. Yeah, so it could be, it's a really solid house, neat, performs well, good, okay rent, you know. However, I know, like I was saying before, a really light cosmetic uplift, I know you're going to get great rent from that. Or the backyard, I can, you know, obviously do the measurements and everything through software that we use. You know, there is ample room here to put a granny flat at the back. Or so it's always got that little twist, a property with something else to offer, you know. And it could be that, there's a lot of properties I find that have got untouched opportunities as well. So one, there was a corner block in Newcastle, had a really cute little cottage at the front. And when I spoke to the town planner before we bought for the client, I said, you know, can I get a granny flat? And here he goes, you know, with this zoning and that size land, you can actually subdivide it. So here we are thinking we'll chuck a little granny on the back, and actually we've got two parcels of land in New Lambton in Newcastle, and the agent obviously hadn't done their due diligence and the owner was unaware of it. So it's like the value that we paid way under where it should have been valued, I think, is the ultimate, you know, message out of that formula. And that happens, you know, I find that happens a lot.
and out of that, you're yeah, you've got the opportunity to subdivide and sell off one or the other, or increase the value of those properties and then help that investor get into more the more property. Absolutely. And overall, all of these extra dwellings that are going onto these properties, it's actually helping the rental crisis, isn't it? Because you're helping to provide more supply to the market.
Yeah.
Which overall, if there was enough supply, it would actually help to stop the increase in rents as much. And that's the main thing and that can be done and can only be done to be able to help this rental crisis in a lot of areas. So, these duloks, getting those second incomes in existing properties, is really helping this rental crisis. So,
yeah. And I'll say to anyone who's listening, who's looking to invest, don't just chuck a granny on the back of any old block. It's got to have enough side access.
It's got to be appropriate, yeah.
Yeah, like you want to make sure that the people who live in both dwellings have outdoor space that's private, that you can put a nice privacy screening up, that your person living out the back doesn't have to walk past the kitchen window of the first person at the front. So I look for wide driveways, you know, a discreet footpath, enough room that it doesn't look weird, that you want to make sure that one side of the house,
And you don't have to squeeze past the hot water system to get down there. And it's just like, and that's why you need a good buyer's agent to find the appropriate property. Yeah. You touched on off-market properties.
Mm.
Now, that's something that's with the rise of the buyer's agent has in the last number of years has become more prevalent as well. So how many properties do you think are not being listed on the major portals and getting sold off market from your experience?
I actually read this statistic through realestate.com.au where they did some study. It's a big number. I'm going to say like a 40%, but I could be off a little bit. But I remember thinking, wow, that's a big number. But I would suggest 50%. So obviously I'm over and above what the mainstream would be doing. But to people like, how do you find these properties, or why would anyone list off market? But there could be privacy. It could be you don't want the neighbours going through your house, or to know that you're, there's financial issues or marriage breakdown. It could be like in my circumstance, like I've got three sons. If I had my house on the market, I'm trying to keep it clean with young children, you know, not a fun time at all for anybody, not when you're trying to work as well. So it could be that I would say to an agent, you know what, this is my price and I'm happy for you to show some people, but as opposed to me doing a full-blown campaign where I might have to like half move out of the house, stage it, do all the marketing, you know, so there's a hurt cost around that for a seller.
Yeah, well, the exorbitant listing costs from both real estate and domain, that can be a hindrance as well. To a turnoff, you know, it could cost them $4,000-$5,000 to list on both sites. So I guess where I'm wanting to sort of ask, do you think these off-market properties and buyer's agents allowing for these off-market properties to have its marketplace? Do you think that's making a dent in the monopoly that that realestate.com.au has, and and in some markets the duopoly with Domain?
Oh, look, yeah, I guess so. I think it's an unfair advantage. I think you could say, you know, for somebody who's never bought a property before, who doesn't know how to have those conversations with selling agents, you know, can you add me to your database? Do you have a off-market database? Do you, you know, they may not understand how you can scratch the surface and get those little secret pre-market, you know, tips. You know, it could be just that the vendor has to make a really quick buying or selling decision. It should be selling decision. So an inexperienced buyer may not be aware that even off-market exists, or the volume of off-market. So, you know, off-market technically is untraceable online, but in reality, it's not on real estate, it's not on Domain, but it could be on the local Bell property website. But it just hasn't been floated to the biggies, because that's when the seller gets their big that's when they get their big fat invoice, because they're not cheap platforms to advertise on. So look, many vendors would say, "Here, let's just do a little quiet. Let's just do your database blast." Again, that's, you know, I've had text messages. I bought off a text message once because the agent said, you know, I've got this property and it's the woman selling it, you know, probably had a toe or two in the hoarding pool, and he knew it was going to be really hard for him to show it, and he wanted to see. I can see the bones of the property, and I work with, you know, a lot of my clients are quite savvy investors, and they know what I know what I'm looking at. And I wound up getting...
You can see past the mess and the hoarding that might be in a property.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, but I mean, the off markets, especially in a busy market when it's not much stock around, and I'm seeing this a lot at the moment, Owen, because I think 2023 made people a little bit nervous and they didn't want to sell in case they couldn't find something to buy, and no one was making big buying decisions necessarily because I didn't know when the RBA might stop. So a lot of people were kind of going, maybe I will, maybe I won't. I might just see, and I might just float it with the agent and see what, you know. So I feel like on the back of that, we're still seeing a lot of these off markets emerge.
Okay. All right. Interesting times. Now, there's also a lot of media activity talking about how people in Sydney especially, but also Melbourne and to a larger extent now in Brisbane, because of the price growth in Brisbane. But a lot of people saying that younger people will never get a foothold with being able to buy a house in that market, you know, and they're needing to work and they'll live close to where they work, and to be able to buy what they want to live in, it's just going to be impossible. Do you get many clients coming to you asking these questions of how you can help, and what is it you suggest? I'm sure there's a lot of times where you wouldn't be able to help, but what advice do you give them? For people who are listening, who are in that situation, what advice can we give them to be able to get a start at least?
Yeah, look, it's a really valid question. Starting, I guess, when you meet with a broker, and I'm always pro brokers ever going to a bank. I mean, they've got aggregator, they've got access to all the lenders. They can tell you what you what your borrowing capacity looks like, and then almost give you a health check. They're like, pay off your HECS debt, or, you know, you've got student loans or a car loan or some one of these crazy, you know, the retail, you know, prepays or whatever those things are called. Clean up your finances, and this is going to be what you're going to borrow. And if it still falls flat of the zone you want to be in, or ideally, there are other things like, you know, parental guarantors. I've had young people come as joint venture partners, so where, okay, you know, friends have come together with a borrowing capacity. And my recommendation is, even in the best of friendships, always have, you know, an agreement drawn up. It's like, you know, our buying's this, our
excess. And is that for investment or to live in?
Usually. I've had them live in, but that particular scenario has played out a lot more with investments. But they're all first-time investors as well that have done that.
Okay. Yeah.
The other thing with the first home buyers, I know, you know, you don't want to pay rent. The rental market's tough at the moment. I don't think that's going to change, you know, as we've already discussed. But other ways of looking at it is, you know, maybe it's not a house that you're moving into. Maybe it is an apartment. Perhaps buying in your local area is not going to be the right fit with your budget. Just get on the ladder. So if that does mean that you need to look at another capital city or a major regional hub, you know, where there's multitude of employment and universities, just get your foot on the ladder and hope, and then rent vest, you know, like, again, I know it's a tricky market, but it can be done. You know, there's, you know, just never take no for an answer. You know, there's always a way. And the other thing is, with a lot of the first home owner incentives, sometimes it can be a false economy. Like, I'm trying to buy something and it's got to be under 900,000 or 800,000 so I can save on stamp duty. So therefore I'm buying further afield in an area I hate. It's a little bit crappy, whatever it might be, because then I'm going to save my, you know, $35,000. It's a big number, but some people chase the wrong thing. I think you need to make sure you buy something that's a sound investment, not just because you're going to save a little bit of money, whether it's a 10K incentive or some sort of kickback on stamp duty as well.
Yeah, and I think that's where the value of the first homeowner grants have really lost its value in recent years, because the prices where a lot of people could buy have grown so much, and for where they want to live. And so, yeah, they're having to go further afield. And yes, if they keep on upping the price market of where these grants sort of stop, then the prices just keep on racing up to that ceiling. So it's now becoming a false event anyway. This is actually, I wasn't planning on talking about this, but seeing it's come up, talking about stamp duty and first homeowner grants and so on, it's the previous New South Wales state government tried to bring in a land tax in replacement of stamp duty for first home buyers. And I think it was a bit of a litmus test to see how that would go for then expanding it across the rest of the market. Have you, you know, looked into that? What are your thoughts about how that would help a lot more fluidity in the market, and people being able to sell and downsize easier because they wouldn't have that huge stamp duty cost and so on? So not sure if it's something that you've done the numbers on.
None of my clients have taken that path, and I don't even know how well that actually did perform as a concept itself.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really in there for long enough, and then the new government that came in promptly dumped it. But
yeah, look, I guess it's one of those things, like, if you buy into an apartment, which there's some of the first home owner grants for Sydney buyers. Unless you move, you know, well out of the 15-kilometre radius of the CBD, you are buying into a strata complex. You know, let's be honest here. It is, you know, whether it be a townhouse. But so you've got ongoing strata costs. So you need to factor those in. You need to be making sure that what you buy is not, as an owner-occupier, is not going to be crippling your lifestyle. You don't want to hate your life for 5 years and eat two-minute noodles just so you could, you know, cut a few bus stops or train station stops off where, you know, you really could afford. So I feel like any enduring annual land tax or something like that is just another headache. It's just another cost. It's just another, here it is again. I've got another big bill. And this is the thing with strata. I've looked at some of the properties, especially in the CBD for apartment buyers. And they're like, some of those stratas are $3,000 a quarter.
Yeah,
it's nuts. It's pools, it's lifts, it's making it fire safe. You know, a lot of these, you know, buildings weren't built in such a way that there are, you know, now the new safety rules.
Mm-hmm.
And as I splinter off into different areas and I go to older apartments, you know, and there's always, you know, it's just, you've got to come up with that money. You know, every quarter you're going to have to factor in this additional cost.
If all buyers didn't have that huge stamp duty cost up front, and they have the ability, because they have the income, to be able to afford an ongoing cost, but they don't have that lump sum up front, which in some cases in Sydney can be easily 100, 150 grand in stamp duty. It would mean that they could buy, instead of into a strata complex, they could maybe buy a small house and not have those strata costs. But it would mean that they had that extra cash to go in as a deposit, and then they wouldn't have the extra loan.
Better. Yeah. Look, absolutely. And there's a lot of merit in that. I guess the beauty of that is, yes, you've got that enduring cost of factoring, but what you've bought is better. And therefore, when you buy a house or something that's outside a strata, you can change it, you know, like within, you know, council approvals, but it can be ugly. It can have a bad, you know, the garden, the external facade could be ugly, but so many things could be, you know, gentrified quite easily with some elbow grease and if you did have some funds to throw at it. So what you're making a valid point in that if it became a crippling cost ongoing, at least you can add value to something like that. So, yes, you know, the exit strategy could be I'm going to beautify it and then I might have to sell it, but yes, you can get into the market and you can buy something a little step up because those funds that you had on reserve for stamp duty are now going into the calibre of the property you're buying initially.
Yes, and if they have the ability from a cash flow income point of view to be able to pay then on an ongoing basis, then it's happy days for everyone. It's a no-lose situation for anyone. So, yeah, so something that I like to get on my soapbox about every so often is, stamp duty reform and how we can make it easier for people to get into the right properties that are right for them. But and that's why the one way that the governments could in fact help the situation. So, Joe, we always have these types of conversations, whether it's when we catch up in person or when we get on the phone once every so often. But thank you for coming on the podcast, and so that we could actually record it and share our thoughts with everyone else. And I'm sure you live on all of the important social platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, etc. Is that the best place for people to find you?
I'm everywhere, so just Google me. You won't find anything too feral behind the scenes at all. I'm across all the platforms.
All right, great. Well, we'll be sharing this not just on the podcast, but all our socials, and we'll certainly tag you. So if people find us through us, they can find you. So cool. Thanks again.
Thank you.
See you soon, Joe. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.